Chapter 4. Of a fatal infatuation for an unworthy, aha! Church's la femme, Mr. Vladimir deigned to interrupt, unbending, but without affability. There was, on the contrary, a touch of grimness in his condescension. How long have you been employed by the embassy here? He asked. Ever since the time of the late Baron Stott Wartenheim, Mr. Verloc answered in subdued tones, and protruding his lips sadly, in sign of sorrow for the deceased diplomat. The first secretary observed this play of physiognomy steadily. Ah! Ever since. Well, what have you got to say for yourself? He asked sharply. Mr. Verloc answered with some surprise that he was not aware of having anything special to say. He had been summoned by a letter, and he plunged his hand busily into the side pocket of his overcoat. But before the mocking, cynical watchfulness of Mr. Vladimir, concluded to leave it there. Bah! Said that letter. What do you mean, by getting out of condition like this? You haven't got even the physique of your profession. You a member of a starving proletariat, never. You a desperate socialist or anarchist, which is it? Anarchist, stated Mr. Verloc in a deadened tone. Bosh! Went on Mr. Vladimir, without raising his voice. Who startled old Wormt himself? You wouldn't deceive an idiot. They all are that by the by, but you seem to me simply impossible. So you began your connection with us, by stealing the French gun designs. And you got yourself caught. That must have been very disagreeable to our government. You don't seem to be very smart. Mr. Verloc tried to exculpate himself huskily. As I've had occasion to observe before, a fatal infatuation for an unworthy, Mr. Vladimir raised a large white, plump hand. H, yes. The unlucky attachment of your youth. She got hold of the money, and then sold you to the police, eh? The doleful change in Mr. Verloc's physiognomy, the momentary drooping of his whole person, confessed that such was the regrettable case. Mr. Vladimir's hand clasped the ankle reposing on his knee. The sock was of dark blue silk. You see, that was not very clever of you. Perhaps you are too susceptible. Mr. Verloc intimated in a throaty, veiled murmur that he was no longer young. Oh! That's a failing which age does not cure, Mr. Vladimir remarked, with sinister familiarity. No. You are too fat for that. You could not have come to look like this, if you had been at all susceptible. I'll tell you what I think is the matter. You are a lazy fellow. How long have you been drawing pay from this embassy? 11 years, was the answer, after a moment of sulky hesitation. I've been charged with several missions to London, while His Excellency Baron Stott Wartenheim was still ambassador in Paris. Then by His Excellency's instructions I settled down in London. I am English. You are? Are you? Eh? A natural-born British subject, Mr. Verloc said stolidly. My father was French, and so, never mind explaining, interrupted the other. Dare say you could have been legally a Marshal of France, and a Member of Parliament in England, and then, indeed, you would have been of some use to our embassy. This flight of fancy provoked something like a faint smile on Mr. Verloc's face. Mr. Vladimir retained an imperturbable gravity. But, as I've said, you are a lazy fellow. You don't use your opportunities. In the time of Baron Stott Wartenheim we had a lot of soft-headed people running this embassy. They caused fellows of your sort to form a false conception of the nature of a secret service fund. It is my business to correct this misapprehension by telling you what the secret service is not. It is not a philanthropic institution. I've had you called here on purpose to tell you this. Mr. Vladimir observed the forced expression of bewilderment on Verloc's face, and smiled sarcastically. I see that you understand me perfectly. I dare say you are intelligent enough for your work. What we want now is activity. On repeating this last word, Mr. Vladimir laid a long white forefinger on the edge of the desk. Every trace of huskiness disappeared from Verloc's voice. The nape of his gross neck became crimson above the velvet collar of his overcoat. His lips quivered before they came widely open. If he'll only be good enough to look up my record, he boomed out in his great, clear oratorical bass, you'll see I gave a warning only 3 months ago, on the occasion of the Grand Duke Romuald's visit to Paris, which was telegraphed from here to the French police, and, tut, tut, broke out Mr. Vladimir, with a frowning grimace. He French police had no use for your warning. Don't roar like this. What the devil do you mean? With a note of proud humility, Mr. Verloc apologized for forgetting himself. His voice, famous for years at open-air meetings and at workmen's assemblies in large halls, had contributed, he said, to his reputation of a good and trustworthy comrade. It was, therefore, a part of his usefulness. It had inspired confidence in his principles. Was always put up to speak by the leaders at a critical moment, Mr. Verloc declared, with obvious satisfaction. There was no uproar above which he could not make himself heard, he added, and suddenly he made a demonstration. Allow me, he said, with lowered forehead, without looking up, swiftly and ponderously he crossed the room to one of the French windows. As if giving way to an uncontrollable impulse, he opened it a little. Mr. Vladimir, jumping up amazed from the depths of the armchair, looked over his shoulder, and below, across the courtyard of the embassy, well beyond the open gate, could be seen the broad back of a policeman watching idly the gorgeous perambulator of a wealthy baby, being wheeled in state across the square. Constable, said Mr. Verloc, with no more effort than if he were whispering, and Mr. Vladimir burst into a laugh on seeing the policeman spin round, as if prodded by a sharp instrument. Mr. Verloc shut the window quietly, and returned to the middle of the room. With a voice like that, he said, putting on the husky conversational pedal, I was naturally trusted, and I knew what to say to. Mr. Vladimir, arranging his cravat, observed him in the glass over the mantelpiece. I dare say you have the social revolutionary jargon by heart well enough, he said contemptuously. Oxet. Dot, you haven't ever studied Latin, have you? No, growled Mr. Verloc. Who did not expect me to know it? I belong to the million. Who knows Latin? Only a few hundred imbeciles who aren't fit to take care of themselves. For some 30 seconds longer Mr. Vladimir studied in the mirror the fleshy profile, the gross bulk, of the man behind him. And at the same time he had the advantage of seeing his own face, clean-shaved and round, rosy about the gills, and with the thin sensitive lips formed exactly for the utterance of those delicate witticisms which had made him such a favorite in the very highest society. Then he turned, and advanced into the room with such determination, that the very ends of his quaintly old-fashioned bow necktie seemed to bristle with unspeakable menaces. The movement was so swift and fierce that Mr. Verloc, casting an oblique glance, quailed inwardly. Aha! You dare be impudent, Mr. Vladimir began, with an amazingly guttural intonation, not only utterly un-English, but absolutely un-European, and startling even to Mr. Verloc's experience of cosmopolitan slums. Who dare? Well, I am going to speak plain English to you. Voice won't do. We have no use for your voice. We don't want a voice. We want facts, startling facts, damn you, he added, with a sort of ferocious discretion, right into Mr. Verloc's face. Don't you try to come over me with your Hyperborean manners, Mr. Verloc defended himself huskily, looking at the carpet. At this his interlocutor, smiling mockingly above the bristling bow of his necktie, switched the conversation into French. You give yourself for an agent provocateur. ... The proper business of an agent provocateur is to provoke. As far as I can judge from your record kept here, you have done nothing to earn your money for the last 3 years. Nothing, exclaimed Verloc, stirring not a limb, and not raising his eyes, but with a note of sincere feeling in his tone. have several times prevented what might have been. There is a proverb in this country which says prevention is better than cure, interrupted Mr. Vladimir, throwing himself into the armchair. He is stupid in a general way. There is no end to prevention. But it is characteristic. They dislike finality in this country. Don't you be too English. And in this particular instance, don't be absurd. The evil is already here. We don't want prevention, we want cure. He paused, turned to the desk, and turning over some papers lying there, spoke in a changed businesslike tone, without looking at Mr. Verloc. You know, of course, of the international conference assembled in Milan? Mr. Verloc intimated hoarsely that he was in the habit of reading the daily papers. To a further question, his answer was that, of course, he understood what he read. At this, Mr. Vladimir, smiling faintly at the documents he was still scanning one after another, murmured, as long as it is not written in Latin, I suppose. Or Chinese, added Mr. Verloc stolidly. H'm. Some of your revolutionary friends' effusions are written in the Charabia every bit as incomprehensible as Chinese. Mr. Vladimir let fall disdainfully a gray sheet of printed matter. What are all these leaflets headed FP, with a hammer, pen, and torch crossed? What does it mean, this FP? Mr. Verloc approached the imposing writing table. The future of the proletariat. It's a society, he explained, standing ponderously by the side of the armchair, not anarchist in principle, but open to all shades of revolutionary opinion. Are you in it? One of the vice presidents, Mr. Verloc breathed out heavily, and the first secretary of the embassy raised his head to look at him. Then you ought to be ashamed of yourself, he said incisively. Isn't your society capable of anything else but printing this prophetic bosh in blunt type on this filthy paper, eh? Why don't you do something? Look here. I've this matter in hand now, and I tell you plainly that you will have to earn your money. The good old Stott-Wartenheim times are over. No work, no pay. Mr. Verloc felt a queer sensation of faintness in his stout legs. He stepped back one pace, and blew his nose loudly. He was, in truth, startled and alarmed. The rusty London sunshine struggling clear of the London mist shed a lukewarm brightness into the first secretary's private room. And in the silence Mr. Verloc heard against a window pane the faint buzzing of a fly, his first fly of the year, heralding better than any number of swallows the approach of spring. The useless fussing of that tiny energetic organism affected unpleasantly this big man threatened in his indolence. In the pause Mr. Vladimir formulated in his mind a series of disparaging remarks concerning Mr. Verloc's face and figure. The fellow was unexpectedly vulgar, heavy, and impudently unintelligent. He looked uncommonly like a master plumber come to present his bill. The first secretary of the embassy, from his occasional excursions into the field of American humor, had formed a special notion of that class of mechanic as the embodiment of fraudulent laziness and incompetency. This was then the famous and trusty secret agent, so secret that he was never designated otherwise, but by the symbol Delta, in the late Baron Stott-Wartenheim's official, semi-official, and confidential correspondence, the celebrated agent Delta, whose warnings had the power to change the schemes and the dates of royal, imperial, grand ducal journeys, and sometimes caused them to be put off altogether. This fellow. And Mr. Vladimir indulged mentally in an enormous and derisive fit of merriment, partly at his own astonishment, which he judged naive, but mostly at the expense of the universally regretted Baron Stott-Wartenheim. His late excellency, whom the august favor of his imperial master had imposed as ambassador upon several reluctant ministers of foreign affairs, had enjoyed in his lifetime a fame for an owlish, pessimistic gullibility. His Excellency had the social revolution on the brain. He imagined himself to be a diplomatist set apart by a special dispensation, to watch the end of diplomacy, and pretty nearly the end of the world, in a horrid democratic upheaval. His prophetic and doleful dispatches had been for years the joke of foreign offices. He was said to have exclaimed on his deathbed, visited by his imperial friend and master, "Unhappy Europe! Thou shalt perish by the moral insanity of thy children." He was fated to be the victim of the first humbugging rascal that came along, thought Mr. Vladimir, smiling vaguely at Mr. Verloc. "You ought to venerate the memory of Baron Stott Wartenheim," he exclaimed suddenly. The lowered physiognomy of Mr. Verloc expressed a somber and weary annoyance. "Permit me to observe to you," he said, "that I came here because I was summoned by a peremptory letter. I have been here only twice before in the last 11 years, and certainly never at 11 in the morning. It isn't very wise to call me up like this. There is just a chance of being seen, and that would be no joke for me." Mr. Vladimir shrugged his shoulders. "It would destroy my usefulness," continued the other oddly. "That's your affair," murmured Mr. Vladimir, with soft brutality. "When you cease to be useful, you shall cease to be employed." "Yes. Right off. Cut short. You shall—" Mr. Vladimir, frowning, paused, at a loss for a sufficiently idiomatic expression, and instantly brightened up, with a grin of beautifully white teeth. "You shall be chucked," he brought out ferociously. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.